1:32 on the afternoon of Friday, March 16th, 2012. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Coghill is here, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French, and Senator Paskvin. We're here with two matters to take up today, one HB 80 and the second a part of the committee. I'm hoping to save some time for a work session on the large number of criminal bills we have here, start getting some direction about how we're going to handle them. But first up is HB 80, which we had a initial hearing on about a week and a couple days ago. We didn't have a quorum that day, but we did get a good presentation from the bill's sponsor, who was actually represented that day by his able staff, given your personal travel. We noted at the time we had a large packet of supportive emails from individuals who were behind the bill. I don't think we got much public testimony that day, and we do have a couple people signed up from the public we'll hear from in a minute. I'll just note for the record I've gotten a large number of phone calls just in the last 48 hours about the bill. I think other members may have as well. I'll just say a couple of those phone calls sort of indicated that it's hard to capture that, but it was a little bit of a, I guess, aggressive stance about the bill. It's a bill that deals with aggression. It's kind of interesting. But we've been hearing the bill on a regular schedule, intending to hear the bill. Folks are interested in this bill. I recognize that. We're working through the process and committed to honoring that process. Let's turn to public testimony before we go to some invited testimony about this bill. We have two people signed up to testify. Let's start with Gary Ellis. Mr. Ellis, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and give us your name and affiliation, if any, and we'd be interested in hearing your testimony.
My name is Gary Ellis, and I'm not here representing anyone, just on my own. And I just wanted to, if I could, take a moment to strongly encourage the members of the committee to go ahead and support this bill. Really, there's a couple points I'd like to make about it. One is that, it's the sort of thing where if someone's carrying, a weapon in a defensive situation, which is perfectly legal to do under state law, the last thing a person should have to be doing in a stressful situation where your life is on the line is trying to decide if you can potentially face charges for defending yourself. And this bill, I think, with essentially doing away with the duty to retreat, really addresses that problem and, could potentially save lives in dangerous situations. And in addition, it's not really any new ground. There's a fairly significant majority of states in the lower 48 that don't have duty to retreat. And it's not like it's a license to kill or anything. Those states haven't had problems with doing away with duty to retreat. And I think it's just a really good bill, and I would strongly encourage you to support it. And the Senate will do the right thing and pass it as well.
Mr. Ellis, thank you. We also have another individual, William Pinney. Mr. Pinney, if you're on the line.
Mr. Chairperson, I'm William Pinney, Anchorage, Alaska. I'm representing myself. The items that I'd like to cover here will be the importance of this 20HB80 to protect every citizen of Alaska, the damage that can be done to people's lives without the passage of this bill, examples of the damage without HB 80, and the increase in people over the future that could cause problems. HB 80 is an important tool so that the average person, family member, women, elderly persons that can defend themselves against those that have no respect or concern for other people in our society. Most people that do carry are still in serious jeopardy, that if they feel they can't retreat, a prosecuting attorney right here in Alaska can easily destroy their lives, such as Rodney Lewis in Iowa, a 49-year-old ex-police officer that shot one of two men chasing him, then spending 112 days in jail before they found him not guilty. They did not have legislation in place like this. In turn, Mr. Lewis lost his job, his home, and all his worldly possessions, not to mention then having an arrest record that will follow him the rest of his life. Even though his actions meet every bit of the criteria for the use of deadly force, ability, opportunity, jeopardy, and dissimilarity of force, Mr. Lewis's life was ruined. If anybody wants information on that, I have copies of it here. Thursday, in Washington State, a felon out of prison 3 months broke into a woman's dorm and assaulted them, even before the police got there and arrested the person. As the population increases, the number of deviants willing to do harm to others within the population, percentage-wise, also increases. We should not have to worry that protecting our families, our lives, will be taken away, everything that we have, due to the disregard for a small number of people. Just think, if a family is out with their children where they are legally allowed to be and not being able to retreat safely with their kids, a mother, a father will be putting themselves in the same problem as Mr. Lewis, possibly destroying their entire life. If we are legally allowed to be where we are required, we are required to protect ourselves. The United States Supreme Court has ruled it is not the responsibility of the police to protect us individuals, so they are saying it is our responsibility to protect ourselves. As a combat veteran, I understand just how abhorrent even the thought of having to use deadly force is, but even more than that, I understand that we should be able to live without fear from those that would do us harm. That includes the judiciary system of Alaska. I strongly urge that this bill, HB 80, be passed out of committee. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Pinney, thank you so much for testifying. And let me particularly thank you for bringing up a specific case. This is an issue that I've frequently raised, looking for specific instances where this bill would make a difference in the outcome of a criminal case. I'll be reviewing the facts of the Lewis case, and I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Me to convey to you the literature I have, or do you want to pick it up yourself?
I'd be happy to have you send it to my email address. It's easy to find, and if you send it to me, I'll send it to the rest of the committee members.
Okay, and I am talking to Mr. French?
Yes, it's Senator French.
Okay, thank you, Mr. French. Senator French, I really appreciate that.
Glad.
I haven't got to see you for several years.
Okay. Next up is Brian Judy from the NRA. Mr. Judy, if you're there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, members of the committee, my name is Brian Judy. I'm the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association, and I'm testifying on behalf of NRA members today in support of House Bill 80. This bill is important self-defense legislation that provides that a law-abiding person who is justified in using deadly force in self-defense, very important point. Again, person must be justified in using deadly force in self-defense, then this bill will provide that person has no duty to retreat from an attack if the person is in any place the person has a legal right to be. Existing Alaska law already provides that there is no duty to retreat if a person, again, who is justified in using deadly force, is on premises that the person owns or leases, where they reside, or in a building where the person works. And NRA members believe that a potential victim's life is just as important and worthy of defense if they're in some place they have a legal right to be as if they were in their place of work, their home, their property. For instance, walking back to your car on a sidewalk from a restaurant in the evening, if you're attacked, you have a lawful ability to be in that location. You should be able to defend yourself without concerning yourself with the issue of retreat. So in an encounter that necessitates an individual to use deadly force in self-defense, there are the two considerations that must be taken into account. The primary and most significant consideration is, again, justification. The secondary and much less significant consideration is the question of retreat. So the only time that retreat even becomes a consideration is once the person has made the determination that she is justified in using deadly force in self-defense. I'll take just a quick minute and review the arduous legal requirements in the Alaska statutes for justification. A person may use deadly force in self-defense only if the person reasonably believes the use of deadly force is necessary for self-defense against an imminent threat of five things: death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, or robbery. So to employ self-defense, a person must satisfy both a subjective and objective standard. The person must actually believe that deadly force is necessary to protect herself against one of these imminent serious threats. And secondly, the objective standard, the belief of the potential victim must be one that a reasonable person would have held under similar circumstances. One bit further on justification, the Alaska statutes mention circumstances that specifically do not justify the use of deadly force, or non-deadly force for that matter. That is if the person is engaged in mutual combat, if the person provoked the other's conduct, if the person was the initial aggressor, or if the person was involved in felonious activity or gang activity. In any of these circumstances, the Alaska statute specifically provides that the person is not justified, so then you don't even get into the issue of retreat. So again, summarize, a person using deadly force in self-defense must have justification and must consider that question in the split second she has to decide whether to respond to an aggressor with force. Removing the additional question as to whether or not the person can retreat with complete safety provides one less thing a potential victim must concern herself with in the life or death split second decision-making process. Again, removing the duty to retreat does not in any way change the fact that the person must be justified, going through that arduous statutory construction of justification, and must lawfully be in the place where the act of self-defense occurs. So, under existing law, basically, a person who resists an aggressor bears the risk of a finding that although the response was proportional to the reasonably perceived threat, the person overestimated the difficulty of getting away unscathed and is therefore guilty of a crime despite being justified to react with defensive force. So I think really the bottom line, what this bill does is removing the retreat provision shifts some of the risk calculation back to the aggressor. Victims should have the protection of the law, not criminals. Law-abiding citizens should not fear criminal prosecution when they stand their ground and defend themselves without retreating from any place they have a legal right to be. On behalf of the NRA members in Alaska, I urge your support for House Bill 80. Thank you very much.
Mr. Judy, thank you. Is there anyone else online who'd like to testify about HB 80? I'm sorry? Yeah, we have people on for questions. Right. Thank you. We have one person for invited testimony, but before we get to that, is there anyone else here in the room who'd like to testify about HB 80? That I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony and turn down to invited testimony only. We have Mr. Fayette here. Mr. Fayette, if you'd come forward. In a previous lifetime, I was a prosecuting attorney. I got to know Mr. Fayette during that time, both as an intern and then as a prosecuting attorney with the Anchorage DA's office. Mr. Fayette was there before I started. He's there now that I've been gone. He's got some experience in this area. Mr. Fayette, welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record. Tell us who you are and who you're affiliated with, if anybody, and give us a little bit about your background before you get into your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator French. members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is James Fayette. I'm an assistant district attorney. I work at the Anchorage District Attorney's Office. I've been there for just shy of 20 years. I'll place my general credentials on the record and then turn to my credentials to speak about this bill. I'm a 1988 graduate of the Boston University School of Law. I came to Alaska in 1989 in the Army. I spent 4 years at Fort Richardson. Most of that time was as the military prosecutor at Fort Richardson. I got out of the Army in January of 93 and was hired at the Anchorage District Attorney's Office. I worked there for 11 years handling, for the most part, violent crime offenses. I went to private practice for a year. And in 2005, I came back to the department and supervised the Special Prosecutions Office for 4 years. Since 2009, I've been reassigned to the District Attorney's Office and specially tasked with gang crimes and other complex matters as assigned. I've appeared before this committee before, although it's been a number of years. I'm not sure it's germane, but I remember appearing before this committee in 2006 when I was confirmed as a member of the Judicial Conduct Commission. Turning to my qualifications to speak about this bill, I believe I am, I've taken 14 murder verdicts. Many of those are self-defense cases. Three of them are double homicide cases. Don't ask me how many trials I've done. I've lost track. I've been on the Anchorage Police Department's homicide call-out roster since 1993, which means that when the police department finds a body or there's a major crime, whoever's on duty that week gets a call, and we wind up standing with a patrol officer, a detective, and considering how someone met their end and looking at a dead body before we finish our first cup of coffee in the morning. I've done that, if you ask me to ballpark it, between 60 and 75 times in the last 20 years. I'm presently assigned to three homicide cases. My last homicide grand jury was last week. I've written three law review articles while I've been a prosecutor. The first one I published was in 2006, and it was a survey of Alaska's law of self-defense. It's used currently by judges, public defenders, and prosecutors to navigate self-defense cases, which are notoriously complex. And I know that because I saw a public defender just a month and a half ago carrying my law review article to court, and I regarded it as rather a compliment. I'm routinely asked to teach at the district attorney's annual conference, and I routinely consult with colleagues in other district attorney's offices statewide on pending self-defense cases regarding motions, jury instructions, and such. I don't think it's a stretch to say of all the lawyers in the state that will be affected by this bill, I'm on that short list. I'm currently formally assigned to the violent crimes prosecution section of the Anchorage District Attorney's Office. That's eight lawyers that do nothing but felony prosecution, homicides, felony domestic violence, robberies. We deal with this every day. I should turn to my role here today, Mr. Chairman. I'm here as at the invitation of the chair. I need to emphasize, I am not a department representative today. I'm here on my own behalf. I'm on leave today. I put in a leave slip. I am wearing a suit on a day where I submitted a leave slip, breaking all my personal rules. I traveled from Anchorage this morning at my expense. I don't presume to represent the department as an agency. We have other lawyers that do that, and I don't represent the administration. I do, however, know the opinion of my colleagues. My prosecution colleagues, I know because I've consulted with them and I've discussed this bill with them specifically in the last few weeks in preparation for this hearing today. There's not a single member of the prosecution community that supports this. This is a bad idea. This is a dangerous bill. And I say that with respect to the, I understand the sponsors and the supporters are here in the room, and there's many citizens who in good faith sympathize with what we just heard from the telephonic witnesses. This is a bad idea for reasons I don't know that they anticipate, and that's this. This bill has unintended serious consequences. We just heard a supporter say the victims ought to have rights and should have more rights than the criminals. Well, philosophically, I guess I agree with that, but here's the problem. When people are arrested, when violent criminals are arrested and they come to court, guess what they're going to say? They're going to say self-defense, and they're going to take advantage of the legislation that you're being asked to pass. That's the problem. I prosecute gang members, murderers, drug dealers who settle scores at the point of a gun. They're going to take advantage of this law. I'm watching the clock. I am going to give you four examples of cases where this bill would have made a horribly tragic difference in trial outcomes. I'm going to do that here in a minute. I'm going to show you two video clips from two recent Anchorage cases, and I'm going to tell you about some other cases statewide. May I proceed?
Why don't you stop there for a second, because I think that's a widespread concern. In the emails that I've gotten on this case, over and over and over again, I hear from law-abiding citizens who are absolutely sure that if they use force to defend themselves, that somehow you or someone else is going to prosecute them and put them on trial for having defended themselves.
I was waiting for an example, Senator French. I was waiting for an example. I'm unfamiliar with the one I just heard about cases out of state. I'd love to look into that. But I'm waiting for an example, and I reviewed the record of the hearing that was held last week when the supporters were asked point blank, are you responding to a specific case? Are you responding to a pattern of cases that are of concern? Specifically here in Alaska, I've been a prosecutor in Alaska for 20 years. I'd like to know. And no, was the answer that I heard on this hearing record last week. No, just generally, philosophically, we don't think people should have a duty to retreat. Let me say it a different way. That means it's not a problem. You're being asked to fix a problem that does not exist. There's not a spate of people who are defending themselves, their homes, their children, who are then being indicted and prosecuted. An existing law protects citizens' right to defend themselves in that manner. And
let me just ask another question, and maybe it's oversimplifying it, but when you screen a case in, do you have some sense of who the good guy is and who the bad guy is?
Well,
because I think there's a lot of good people out in society who feel like they're going to get prosecuted unnecessarily. And I guess my sense has been, you know, DAs can tell the difference between who the gang members are and who is a mother defending her children. You know, who is a father defending his daughter or wife. I used the example last week of a grocery store where, you know, a woman's taking her groceries out to the car and putting them in the car, and she's beset by an aggressor. Good guy, bad guy. She, you know, if she needs to, she can use deadly force to protect herself. If someone else is watching that person can use deadly force to stop an armed aggressor in a parking lot, you know, going after, you know, some nice woman taking her groceries home.
Those things are true, and someone defending their children because of the amendment in 2006 does not have a duty to retreat. So there's that. There's also a perception, I've never met Mr. Judy, but I just heard his comments, and the perception from his comments are that someone has to come to court and prove they acted in self-defense. And, of course, that's not true. Self-defense is a defense that a prosecutor has to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. And our case law clearly says even implausible claims of self-defense have to go to a jury, and then the burden shifts to a prosecutor to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, which is notoriously difficult because that means a prosecutor has to do what civil lawyers are never asked to do, to prove a negative proposition beyond a reasonable doubt to the unanimous satisfaction of trial jurors. If you told a civil lawyer to do that, they'd have an aneurysm. They don't have to do that. That's not the burden they bear every day in court, but it's one that the prosecutors work for the Department of Law have to do every day. I was asked to, and I don't know if the court still, or if the court, beg your pardon,
I make
professional
the,
habit.
I make the same mistake from time to time. You'll hear, the past tense made that. You say Your Honor to the,
right,
speaker,
right.
And
It's actually difficult for me not to be standing right now. But I was asked to review statutes. Does the chair want me to do that?
The floor is yours. If you've got a presentation, we should probably get into that presentation.
I do, and I'll try to do this as quickly as I can. I passed out written materials, and if I can manipulate the projector here, I'm not sure if I can put this up on the screen or not. We'll see. I can start from memory. So on, I think, the first page of our handout, or not. There we are. So there are several statutes that come into play, the first being 1181.330. I'll review as much faster than I would if this were a grand jury presentation or a jury trial. There are two statutes that come into play, and it's the second one I'll talk about in a minute that you're being asked to amend. The basic rule of self-defense is found at 1181.330. The first part of that subsection, or first part of that section, basically says you can, if you're attacked, you can defend yourself up to the extent that you reasonably believe it's necessary to defend yourself against an unlawful attack. What follows, subsections A 1 through 3, those are the classic common law disqualifiers, the situations where nobody can say self-defense. And they make sense. You can't say self-defense if it's mutual combat, if you provoke the other person's combat, or if you're the initial aggressor, the theory being that you were the person that could have avoided it. In 2004, the legislature added these subsections. You can't say self-defense if it's you're retaliating or in revenge for gang conduct. You're a participant in a felony drug transaction. That's what 1171 is. Or you're engaged in the commission of a felony. You turn the page to our next statute, which is 335, and you see this is the statute that you're being asked to amend. On this statute, These are the special rules for using deadly force. And deadly force, of course, are guns, knives, actually even just pointing a deadly weapon at somebody. So pointing a gun at somebody counts. That's important in road rage cases. For you to be able to use deadly force, you have to, the jury has to be satisfied that you reasonably believed that what you did was necessary to defend yourself against death, serious physical injury, sexual assault, robbery. And here's the point of the bill, subsection B. You have a duty to retreat. And what Alaska law often said, and I'm down at 1181.335B, since 1980, there was code revision in 78, and so this statute stood on the books, unamended, until 2006. The 1990 amendment was technical, not substantive. You can't use deadly force if you know, with complete personal safety and safety as to others being defended, you can avoid the necessity of using deadly force by leaving the area, which is a fairly modest requirement. That's a high burden. Remember, it's the prosecutor that's got to prove that this doesn't apply. You don't have to prove that you couldn't retreat. The prosecutor's got to prove this. Except there's no duty to retreat, and this is what it used to say. It used to say that homeowners and cops didn't have to retreat for obvious reasons. We don't require homeowners to retreat because that leaves the bad guy in your home with your wife, your valuable, your kids. And we don't want cops to have to retreat because that leaves the barbarians in charge of the streets. So that's what this statute said for years. In 2006, you made this list longer, and you provided that not just owners or lessees didn't have to retreat, but also guests or agents, and so also people who were at their workplace or people who were protecting children. They didn't have to retreat either. So there's our scenario about the woman who's beset by an aggressor in the supermarket parking lot. She doesn't have to retreat. That's a long list of people that don't have to retreat, and what this bill seeks to do is essentially... Oh, I didn't put it here. I beg your pardon. It's on the written handout, not on my... what this bill does is essentially put subsection 5 and says basically nobody has to retreat if they're in a place where they have a right to lawfully be. It would add subsection 5 right there. It basically guts the duty to retreat. As long as you're not trespassing, you don't have to retreat. That's overbroad, and it fixes a problem that doesn't exist. And the concern, of course, from my office, from me, I guess, I don't speak for my office, is that gang members who shoot each other on the streets, and I want to show you an example here in a minute, they're in a place where they have a right to be. And this bill would say they don't have a duty to retreat. Road rage situations where people are chipping teeth at each other or flipping each other off and then somebody pulls a gun. They're on a highway. They don't have a duty to retreat either. And I'm going to give you examples of that where this would have made a difference. So,
Senator Coghill.
Just so that I have the context.
And I know I'm going fast. I think.
And I know, and I appreciate this. So, but 330 says there are, you know, there's mutual combat mm-hmm. and felonious things.
Right.
That does not rule in this case.
Oh, you know what? Thank you very much. Through the chair, I neglected to say that. Look at it does is the answer, and let me show you what I forgot to mention. The very first test at 335, the first two lines there, I should have explained this. So the very first test for use of deadly force is you have to satisfy all the conditions in 1181.330. So in other words, you have to satisfy, if you're boxed out somewhere in 330, then you're similarly boxed out in 335, which means, for example, if you're the initial aggressor, you can't say, you can't use deadly force. Why? Because you're boxed out in 330. So.
Good. Are you, just finish up and then we'll go to the next question.
So the question then is, the mutual aggressors, don't our gang members kind of fall into that in combat, mutual aggressor, or felonious activity?
And through the chair, and the answer is yes, all the time. That's what they do. I mean, the people I prosecute, some of them are committing felonies before lunchtime on a daily basis. But it's disputed, isn't it? And remember, these are propositions that the prosecutor has to disprove. So I'm going to show you a, and it's easily characterized as ambiguous by a skilled defense attorney, which is, of course, their job. And, of course, this is all to the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt to a trial jury who has to agree unanimously that the prosecutor has disproven self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they don't, of course, it's an acquittal. So I'm going to show you a video of a situation that may start out looking really ambiguous, where the defense had they had something to work with. You see what I'm saying? And so where duty to retreat was an important component of the prosecutor's argument, so the prosecutor could say, look, regardless of this, we think this is mutual combat, or we think the man here in the courtroom was the first aggressor, but even if you disagree with all of that, the shots didn't have to be fired. This gentleman could have left the area, and he didn't, and make that finding against him. And this bill, of course, would take away the last part of that argument, and that's the danger.
Senator Wilikowski.
I similar question. I was going to ask the question that Senator Cockell asked on. So you have to run through 330 first. So in other words,
yes.
In the case of gang members shooting each other on the street, you would go through 330 first, right? And then you would look at, say, 330A4C, I guess. And then it would appear that they would not be justified under that section, right?
Yes, if the jury decided that it really truly was retaliation for gang conduct or it was a drug transaction, yes, that's true. That's true.
And the same with road rage, too. That would be if mutual combat under 330A1.
Well, but it would be disputed, and through the chair, it would be disputed whether it was mutual combat or not. And, of course, it would be rare that someone would admit that they had engaged in mutual combat.
Well, that actually makes me wonder. I mean, mutual combat has been, in my view, a bar fight.
Yes.
Right. That's the classic bar fight. Poke each other in the chest until you both cock back, and there you go at it. That's a bar fight. And
right.
So no one can claim self-defense. A road rage, interesting question. Certainly people flip each other off, but is that mutual combat, flipping each other off at a stoplight?
Well, again, that's a proposition that will always be disputed in every case that goes to trial, and the burden's on the prosecutor to prove that it is mutual combat. That's my point. And if that's disputed, the jury's going to be told repeatedly, resolve any ambiguity in the defendant's favor. So that's the difficult proposition. So,
Senator McGuire.
Thank you so much, and through the chair, and thank you for all that you do in terms of crime and prosecuting in my community. My district is in Anchorage, and I've followed your work and seen your name over the last couple of decades as a lifelong Alaskan. So thank you for choosing to come here from Boston and making your career. Question for you, and I don't recall the name of the case, and so I'm going to just give you the vague details that I remember. It was in the Valley. There was a gentleman out there that was the owner of a church, and he had some young men that kept breaking in on a repeated basis, and he finally caught them. They were fleeing the church, and he shot them and hit one of them in the back. And a decision was made to prosecute him, as I recall, and the jury ended up finding in his favor. And it was an interesting case, of course, because clearly the criminal had already retreated or was leaving, and so it brought up all kinds of issues. And I was just wondering, as I think about this, I think you bring up some really good points to think about. I'm a co-sponsor of this bill. I think you'll see many, I think Senator Wilikowski and others, a lot of people in the legislature that tend to be supportive of Second Amendment rights. You'll see their names on this bill. So you're probably aware of that, but just to give you a little bit of kind of the political flavor of the bill, those are the sponsors that you see. And so when you first heard this bill from Representative Newman, you say to yourself, absolutely, this is Alaska, and we respect the right to bear arms and to defend yourself. Sign me up. But you're bringing up some very important considerations, especially the fact that, is it going to make it more burdensome if every defendant goes in now and claims this? I had a duty to be here. I had a right to be here. But with respect to that one case, I would just like to hear your thoughts, because the chairman made an observation that I think is right, that generally speaking, you know who the good guys and the bad guys are, and it's rare that you see somebody unfairly prosecuted, although I'll point to the Ted Stevens case at the federal level and the report that was just delivered, sadly, as an indictment of our system of justice 2 days ago. That said, in that case, what was the outcome? Why was there a decision to prosecute? And how do you see this bill entering into the fact pattern associated with the church?
Thank you, Senator, through the chair. My gosh, I could talk for a long time on the issues that you raised. I agree that today is a hard day to be a prosecutor. I read the articles about the Ted Stevens prosecution, and time doesn't permit me to respond other than to say that a defendant's discovery rights in state court, and I've written about this, that's one of my other law review articles, are much broader than in federal court. And more than that, I don't feel comfortable saying because I haven't digested all of that. But I can tell you that my colleagues take that story to heart, and I've written about it. That's as much as I can say about that now. I'm not going to dodge that. It's a hard day to be a prosecutor.
Understood.
And I anticipated something like that being mentioned here today. On Second Amendment rights, absolutely. And if anybody listening to the sound of my voice, by the way, I'm a Vermonter. I went to law school in Boston. And I hope no one thinks that I'm an anti-gun rights crusader. I'm not.
No.
I'm a gun owner. I consider myself a fairly politically conservative person. And I'm an Army veteran. I'm an airborne school veteran. I taught my 13-year-old son how to shoot last summer. And I'm a prosecutor. I live at the end of a mountain road in Eagle River, and I'm a guy whose name and whose paper appear, photograph appear in the paper periodically, in gang cases. And I don't wear this on my sleeve. I don't talk about it a whole lot, but retaliation against prosecutors happens. I'm a gun owner. Enough said about that. About the case in Wasilla, I remember that case. I was not directly involved, and there were actually two men that were shot. I believe one in the back. I did not directly participate in the case. What I know about that case is from media reports and my memory. It was a controversial case. But what I will say, and what I think is germane to our discussion, is the gentleman was acquitted. He was not indicted for murder. He was indicted for manslaughter. It was a controversial case. They were running away from, as I recall, an unoccupied building. And he shot at least one man in the back. And he had a jury trial. And he was acquitted. Under law that existed before the duty retreat was expanded in 2006 by the legislature. So existing law, that's what the case was, 2001 or 2002, that's my memory. It worked for him. He was acquitted for killing two men. It's a rather solemn thing. I express no opinion one way or the other, but I'll just point that out. That, he was indicted by a grand jury, and he had procedural safeguards, grand jury review of his case. I don't know if there were pretrial motions practiced, but if there were legal errors or insufficient evidence, he could have asked a judge to throw out the indictment. I know who defended him. It was one of the best trial lawyers in the state, Mr. Gilmore. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that was explored. And he was acquitted. And I've been waiting for an example from an Alaska case. And so your question raises the only one I can think of.
Yeah.
So I was asked to give examples from Alaska cases, and I would like to do that. I'm actually not watching the clock, Senator. So
I am, and I had planned to do some work on criminal bills after this, but this is worthwhile, and I think the committee's time is well spent. Everyone's interested, and so take your time and proceed.
Okay, I'll turn to specific examples. I've given you news clippings, members of the committee, from some of these cases. I'm going to show you a video clip of manipulate this. The first case, it's the Daily News story on the Vong Thongdi case. I'm sorry if I'm making people dizzy. I need to get to the right. Okay, I need to set this up real quickly. I'm going to pause a rather blurry security video, and I need to say a few words about this. What I'm about to show you is not a particularly long video clip. It's a security video. This is public information. This was used as a trial exhibit. And I'm going to show you a video of a man being shot by a man, Mr. Vong Thongdi, who, frankly, is a poster child for gun control. He was a felon. He was drunk. He was in a bar. I'm not going to show you the video clip of him walking out of the bar, staggering down Third Avenue in Anchorage. And what you're going to see happen, he's waving his gun over his head. And what you're going to see happen is Mr. Vong Thongdi walk over to this car right here. And what happened is he pops a shot off in the air, and a gentleman who's an off-duty military policeman, he's the rather striking-looking gentleman that you have a color photograph of in the packet, is doing nothing wrong. He's out. His name's Evan Manier, and he's out for a night on the town with his friends. He's waiting for a cab, and you'll see him come into the picture. He was an off-duty military policeman. And Mr. Vong Thongdi, you'll see how it escalates so quickly, and you'll see Mr. Manier shot. Now, this is not a couple things. This is not graphic. It's a distant security video. You can see what happens. There's no blood in the video I'm going to show you. And I'll also say that I called Mr. Manier's mother 2 days ago, and I said, look, I'm going to Juneau to testify about this bill. And I don't need it. It's a public document. Do I have your permission to show this image? And she graciously gave me that permission. And I also asked her for permission to show her the photograph of the Mr. Manier's face that I just showed you, or that's in your packet. So let me fast forward this, and let me show you what happens, and I'll explain. Mr. Vong Thongdi is standing. This is a security video, and that's this is Third Avenue in Anchorage. Mr. Vong Thongdi is here. He staggered out of a bar. He and his friends walked over to this car. In just a second, you're going to see him raise his hand and fire a shot recklessly in the air. And there's going to be a circle swipe here, right here. That was a shot being fired into the air by a drunken man who is a felon that never should have had a gun to begin with, and who other security video showed him staggering down here. Mr. Manier was over here, a little bit to the east on 3rd Avenue. Mr. Vong Thongdi has got a white T-shirt hanging underneath his Jack Daniels jacket, and here comes Mr. Manier in the... It's not mine.
Anybody know what that is? Whoever's on the teleconference, please mute your you've got your music coming on. Thank you. One of the other LIOs. Oh, not here. Right. Yeah. Someone who's listening, either Miss Monfrida or Mr. Judy, or okay. So
just cut him off.
Yeah, can you just cut the video, the audio from there?
Just disconnect
the telephone. Any way to disconnect the telephone line? Well, they can watch on Gavel to Gavel, or they can listen on the web TV. We've got this is streaming live to the internet. Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Mr. Fayette.
Mr. Chairman, I paused the video at the point where Mr. Vong, and I hope you can make this out. This is Mr. Manier in the white shirt, and this is Mr. Vong Thongdi wearing a black jacket with a white T-shirt underneath. And watch what happens next. This is how quickly these things escalate. Mr. Vong Thongdi leans in on Mr. Manier. Mr. Vong Thongdi's friends join him. Mr. Manier's girlfriend comes over here, presumably to break things up. Mr. Vong Thongdi's friends pushes the two men apart. They both go down. Mr. Manier gets up and pushes Mr. Vong Thongdi's friend. Mr. Vong Thongdi goes down, and watch what happens next. Boom, he just shot him.
Oh, wow. God. Yeah.
He shot him right in the center line with a .40 caliber pistol, and then he runs away. Mr. Vong Thongdi, based on what you just saw, claimed self-defense at trial. He claimed a valid use of self-defense at trial. And after protracted legal argument towards the close of the trial, the judge ruled for various legal reasons that he was not entitled to a self-defense claim. But part of my argument was the duty to retreat, that Mr. Vong Thongdi had the opportunity, if he wanted, to simply walk away from that man, and did not.
Walk away from Mr. Manier?
Yes.
From the law, right.
And you see how the other things were. Was he the initial aggressor? Well, not really. He was walking away, and Mr. Manier was walking up. That was disputed. Was it mutual combat? Well, again, that's disputed. Was it gang conduct? Not apparently.
Wasn't any combat to be mutual.
I beg your pardon?
Wasn't any combat to be mutual.
They are. And so what the one a facet of the prosecution, my argument in that case, was that Mr. Von Fongi could have retreated. He was clearly in a place where he could have been, lawfully been. And he and the judge ruled in my favor for... So Mr. Von Fongi was convicted. That case, that's on appeal now, partially for this reason. If this is reversed on appeal, I'll do this trial again. The point being that if House Bill 80 had been law, my task would have been much harder, and had that claim gone to the jury, my task would have been harder still. And Mr. Von Fongi may have been acquitted for what you just saw on the video screen. May I go to my next example,
please?
I'm going to show you... Again, another this is not a graphic video. This is a case about five blocks away. On 4th Avenue, in front of the Rum Runners Bar. That's why I've given you the photograph of the facade of Rum Runners. And I'm going to set this up. This is very fast. These gentlemen are hanging outside of Rum Runners, a very popular bar in Anchorage. The guy in the red jacket is Mr. Tatua. He had gang connections. He was flagging. He's wearing a red jacket, Boston Red Sox jacket, not by mistake. He's a Blood. He's a member of a Blood set. And he's flagging red. The guy's driving up and down the strip here. That's east on 4th Avenue, and this is Rum Runners. Perhaps you're familiar with it. Sunshine Mall's over here. This is close to 1 in the morning on a Saturday night going into Sunday. It's a busy. There's people up and down. It's a popular night spot. Hundreds of people. And they're watching cars cruising the strip. And the guys cruising the strip are the Crips. And you're going to see some of them in a minute. So I'll fast forward this to the just a bit. And you're going to see a shooting develop. And again, it's not graphic. We'll start here. At the 5959 point, which will be in about 10 seconds, this gives you a sense of how crowded this is. It's 1 in the morning. This is not quite bar break. And here's Mr. Tatua and his friends standing over here. And they're bopping to the music. They have music playing out there in the sidewalk. And they see somebody come by. And look, they come off the wall. And look at this. They're flagging. They raise their hand. Oh, I just backed it up just a little bit. Right there. You know, are they flipping somebody off? Are they flashing a gang sign? I don't know. But they come out, and these guys, the other guys, stop in traffic, and you're going to see a battle line develop. These three guys are going to line up. One, two, three. Oops. Oops. One, two, three, four. And watch what happens next. One of the Crips throws a punch. Knocks this guy back, and watch what Mr. Tatua does. He comes up, bang, shoots this guy twice, turns, and then bang, three more shots. It happened just that fast. He emptied a five-round, I think it was a 38. It was a five-shot revolver. And all the witnesses described the shots as like that. And the man he shot, no angel. His name was Angel Martin Lara. He's a gang member. He's a street tough. And he or his companion threw the first punch. I'm going to show this to you again. I prosecuted Mr. Tatua.
In the red jacket.
The man in the red jacket, the man that fired the shots at this gentleman. We'll just run this through really quickly again. There's Mr. Martin Lara. He shot twice, once in the leg, once in the buttocks. And then Mr. Tatua has already fired three shots up 4th Avenue. I'll tell you more about that in just a second. By the way, it's an interesting aside. Where's a cop when you need one? About 50 feet away. There's an Anchorage Police Department officer here on 4th Avenue, and there's Mr. Tatua running away, and a very brave Anchorage Police Department officer is on scene within seconds. Those are police emergency lights. There are two police officers, actually, but... Officer Rivera, who's about my size, is right there and arrests Mr. Tatua. Mr. Tatua's defense at trial was self-defense. He argued self-defense on what you just saw right there. He was responding to non-deadly force with deadly force. And there were a variety of reasons why I argued, and this went to the jury, by the way. This claim went to the jury. The judge let this claim go to the jury. And I argued there were a variety of reasons why that self-defense claim failed. That it was gang conduct, so I argued. He had provoked the conduct by flashing these guys out in traffic, but also that he had a duty to retreat. There's security staff here. There's a big bar. At what point could he have retreated? When he came off the wall and you see these guys come out, he could have retreated then, or specifically before he fired the last three shots. And you might say to yourself, all right, Mr. Fayette, so what? A gang guy shot another gang guy. I'm telling you, Mr. Martin Law is an admitted gang member. He's been on national television making general threats against the public in the Ice Cold Killer shows. Somebody might say, why are you wasting your time? Why are you prosecuting gang members for shooting gang members? Fair question. There's a highbrow answer and a lowbrow answer to that question. The highbrow answer, of course, is that all life is valuable. We should protect all life. Who among us can say that Mr. Martin Lara won't turn a new leaf? I've met Mr. Martin Lara's stepfather, who actually loves him dearly, and would be devastated if he was killed. He wasn't. He was injured and he recovered. He didn't cooperate with the prosecution, I can tell you that. He's a street tough. That's the, you know, John Donne, no man is an island, every man's loss makes us poor. That's the highbrow answer, but I'm not a philosopher, I'm just a lawyer for the state, that's all I'll ever be. My proper response to that question is the lowbrow answer. Why should we care when gang members shoot gang members? It's the picture that you have in your a packet of the young lady in the flower dress, and it's those other three shots. That lady is a young lady named Shauna, and she was on 4th Avenue, further up 4th Avenue, and she caught one of those three shots right in the clavicle, right here, right there. And so the reason is, why do we prosecute gang members for shooting gang members? Because they have bad aim. They often don't hit what they aim at. They haven't had the benefit of NRA certified firing range instruction. They just emptied the cylinder. And that round hit Miss Cult, was her name, and about the only place on her torso where it wouldn't have caused devastating life-changing injury or death. A couple of percentages of a degree. And that shot hits her in the throat, the spine, the head, the heart, the lungs. You can see that as clearly as I can. If House Bill 80 had been law, Mr. Tatua would have had a better claim at self-defense, and then somebody would have had to go explain to Ms. Call or her survivors, I'm sorry, I can't convict the person that shot you and caused your daughter's death. And why we're doing that, I don't know. My head's exploding. I don't know why we're considering doing that. I just don't.
You need to take a moment, because not a lot of people know that if a shot is fired in self-defense, if I am beset by you, you're using armed lethal force against me, I pull out a gun and shoot you and miss you and hit the nice Channel 2 reporter here, that's a lawful death.
Yes, that's true. There's a bit more to that. You have a duty of care, actually, to third parties, but if we're this and that was actually litigated in this case. The jury's instructed that he has a duty of care. He can't be reckless and just start fire. But the jury concluded that he was reckless. He was shooting at somebody. He was running away. The immediate emergency was over, and he emptied his cylinder. He shot. He was trying to shoot rivals in the back as they ran away, as we just saw here. But otherwise, you're right. Transferred intent counts. If they think he was being careful and not wildly firing, then you're right. If you have valid self-defense as to me, then the result is not guilty as to me, as well as not guilty as to the Channel 2 reporter. Mm-hmm. We just implicated it. I'm going to turn to two other cases, if I may. The roster case, I don't have video clips. This is not my case. This is a case, though, the ink is not dry on this judgment. This is from Ketchikan, and the trial occurred just a few months ago. This was a colleague, Mr. Scott, of the Ketchikan office. You've got the facts on the KRBD news story that I just pulled and I'm giving to you. Mr. Roster, 18, was basically a car vandal, going through a trailer park near Ketchikan looking for stuff to steal in cars. And when the trailer occupant encountered him and pulled him out of the car and said, I'm assuming, you know, what are you doing? Get away from my car. Mr. Roster stabbed him to death. He bled out within minutes, and you've got that in the news story. I spoke with my colleague, Mr. Scott, who's the prosecutor in this case. The jury convicted Mr. Rossiter of murder in the second degree. The jury was out for 2 days. They wrestled with this case, 2 days. And the whole case was about duty to retreat. Why? Well, look at those box outs. Was Mr. Rossiter committing a felony? No, actually what he was doing was a misdemeanor. Was he a gang member? No. Was he the initial aggressor? No. One could argue that the car owner's, I think it was his son, adult son, laid hands on people first. So Mr. Rossiter's use was not of force was not boxed out there. The whole case was about duty to retreat, that Mr. Rossiter could have, should have, we wish he did, run away. And so if House Bill 80 had been law, potentially a completely different result at trial. Finally, I've given you the news clipping from a Fairbanks case, a case called Bostick. It's a road rage case. I'm limited as to what I can say about the Bostick case because that jury hung. It's pending retrial. In that case, there was a road rage incident, and Mr. Bostick is alleged to have followed his victim. I think it's to a workplace. You have the facts here from the summary of the facts from the news article. Words are exchanged. I think it's the victim's son gets involved, and Mr. Bostick is alleged to have stabbed the gentleman fatally. Again, that jury hung and is pending retrial, so I'm limited by the ethical rules that govern the bar. I can't say much more than that, and I'm not going to. What I am going to say, though, is this is illustrative of road rage cases. In road rage cases, duty to retreat means you pull over, you step on the brake, and nobody dies. And we're not here. We're not here. I ask you to consider that. I'm very close to concluding my comments. I'll reiterate, this bill dangerously expands the defense of self-defense in a way that's completely unnecessary. There is no immediate crisis. There's no necessity to expand the list of people who do not have a duty to retreat infinitely. It will only benefit criminals, violent criminals, and I've collected four stories here. It will do nothing to enhance the safety of law-abiding gun owners. Absolutely nothing. Existing law defends their right to protect their children, to defend their homes. But what it will do is make it harder for myself and my colleague to convict dangerous criminals. And when you're faced, members of the committee, with existing law, which for all its imperfections tends to protect life, and this proposal, which in my view unwisely, overbroadly devalues life and makes it easier to destroy life, and you're faced with that choice, as you are on this bill, that's an easy call. Pick life. Life is fragile. I've spoken to many dozens of people who have any insight on this issue that maybe perhaps others do not have. And I guess I'm grateful that I'm not a department representative because I'm ending my comments on, more of a personal note than I would if this were my job for the Department of Law. I've spoken with many dozens of crime victim survivors like Miss Rushton. That's the mother of Sergeant Meniere. And that's caused me to realize in a very personal way that life is fragile, life is precious, and it should be protected, and it's because it's so easily extinguished. So when you're faced with a choice of voting on legislation that tends to protect life versus legislation that makes it easier to take it away, that is an easy day at work. Pick life. Unfortunately, I've got many years left before I retire from the state system, and also more unfortunately, other victims' survivors like Ms. Rushton will inevitably follow Ms. Rushton's footsteps into my office, and I will have conversations to explain the legal system to them and the trial dynamics, as it's been my privilege and my duty to do for the last 20 years. Please don't make me have a conversation with those people. that in 2012 the Alaska legislature made it easier to kill people. Senator, you've been very generous with your time and patient with my comments. If there are further questions, I'll respond to them. If not, I will pick up my materials and be on my way.
Mr. Fayette, thank you. Senator Pasman has a question.
Just a question, and I don't know whether it's applicable here, but, you know, with defense of home and the concept of set guns, what impact potentially exists here?
Oh, my gosh. Set guns are a can of worms. Set guns, you're talking about trap guns, where somebody sets up traps. Well, the person who did that would not have a defense under 330 or 335. Why? Because 330 and 335 require a personal threat. Someone's acting in self-defense. But there's another statute, and that's 350, and we're at 350C. By the way, I should have made that clear. 330, 335 are one's personal right of self-defense. That is supplemented by 350C, which is your right to shoot burglars, which you can. But burglary is a term of art. Burglary is occupied dwelling. That's 350. So there would be no right, no defense under 350 to set up. And I'll refer you then to the third page of my handout for the answer to your question. 1181, 350, subsection C2. A person may use deadly force on another, which is what your question, Senator, assumes, when and to the extent the person reasonably believes it's necessary to terminate what the person reasonably believes to be a burglary in any degree occurring in an occupied dwelling or building. And so I would argue that if it's a set gun, there would be no defense under 350C2. I should also say I'm unaware of any set gun case being presented to my office in 20 years, but it's a great maybe my next law review article will be that. Are there further questions, Senator?
I don't see any. Again, we appreciate you coming down on your own nickel and making a strong presentation to the committee. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you for your patience.
We did reserve some time for the bill's sponsor and his representative to come back and close out the presentation. Mr. Newman, Representative Newman, welcome. Mr. Shattuck.
Hey, Mr. Chair. After that, it's kind of hard to just Representative Mark Newman, representing the beautiful Susitna River Valley, District 15. Mr. Chair, after that presentation, I just don't know where to start. Except to thank you for the opportunity to continue the hearing on House Bill 80, which does clarify legislation on an individual's right to self-defense. In the first hearing, we introduced the bill to you, heard testimony from the Department of Law, prosecutors, and the NRA, and I believe Mr. Judy's online for any technical information that the committee might want to have, too, regarding other parts of the law. Mr. Chair, we want to be able to allow you to protect yourself where you have a right to be. It's my belief that our statutes do not protect the rights of individual Alaskans to defend themselves. Prior to filing this legislation, I received a number of contacts from constituents with regards to existing state laws that specifies an individual has a duty to retreat when he or she knows it can be achieved safely. That's what it currently says. Researching this, we found that Alaska was not alone. In fact, 27 other states have found similar deficiencies in their statutes and have taken steps to clarify that a citizen does have the right to defend themselves and they have the right to be. We also found that organizations like the National Rifle Association were engaged in this issue, but Mr. Chair, HB 80 does not change that a jury may hear a case. It sends a clear message to the prosecutors and the courts that an individual has a right to defend themselves anywhere they have a right to legally be. Some arguments have been made over possible costs associated with additional cases of self-defense. HB 80 has not changed anything that gives a defendant additional opportunity to use that defense. I'm not comfortable with an argument that associates cost with human life. I'm not comfortable with an argument that associates cost with human life. And that includes the rights of a person who's innocent, instead of the state where we have everybody's arrested. We're supposed to be innocent until we're proven guilty, instead of everybody being arrested in some of these cases, many of these cases, and you have to prove you're innocent. Senator McGuire brought up a case of a pastor in Big Lake. It cost him his life savings to prove that he was right, to defend his rights as an Alaskan, to defend himself. It cost him everything he had. It should be clear, Mr. Chair, that there's a fundamental right to defend yourself anytime you have a right and a legal place to be. And I want to address some of the information that was put forward here. We started out with the case where it was kind of a fuzzy picture going on here. And we just got a little snippet of this. We weren't here to listen to both sides of the argument. We weren't here to hear all sides of the issue. We heard a very small case in this. And every one of these instances violates the justification clauses. In the first case, we heard about a fellow who was drunk, staggering down the street. First off, that's a felony because he's carrying a weapon. Senator McGuire brought this up in a hearing 2 years ago. If you are intoxicated and you're carrying a weapon and you use that weapon, automatically you're constituting a crime. It's illegal to do that. You can't use a gun and be intoxicated. Our laws already say that that's illegal. And misconduct involving a weapon. You know, it was talked about how Mr. Bartham could have walked away twice. You look in here, was engaged in mutual combat. I would say that both those gentlemen were engaged in a mutual combat. They walked up, his wife walked up behind him. We don't know if he was drinking. We didn't hear that. We know that the other person was drinking, who fired the gun first. They got into a fight, they pushed each other away, came back up, got into a fight, pushed each other away, got back, and then a shot was fired. To me, that's mutual combat. That does not meet justification clauses. Next one was one in front of Rum Riders. We had a bunch of gang members. Gang members. Justification. Persons involved in felonious activity or gang activity. It was stated by Mr. Fayette that they were known gang members, wearing their colors, aggravating an instance. There was somebody shot. There was a witness shot. I'm sorry she was shot. We all are. And as Mr. Chair, you pointed out that that is not a cause. You know, if somebody is innocent, if you're in your home and somebody breaks in, the rights that you have under your, in your home is a Castle Doctrine. If a bullet went through a wall and somebody was struck and hurt, it's, you're still innocent of that because it was an accidental shooting. But what I would like to point out is, what if one of those security guards that was standing there happened to have been armed when Mr. Carlick or one of the other gang members pulled out a gun and started shooting? Would one of those security guards, if he would have been armed and shot Mr. Carlick so that he didn't only shoot four more shots and he didn't hit that young lady in the throat with a bullet, under our laws, he has to retreat. He has a duty to retreat. Instead of helping, trying to defend those other people who were shot. He has full duty to retreat.
I'm going to correct the record. I appreciate your perspective on this.
And I'm not an attorney.
And I think the public is listening to this, and they need to understand that the issue is not whether he could personally retreat, but whether everybody could. And if they can't, then he's authorized to shoot. So if he sees one person walking up to someone else with a gun, he's allowed to use deadly force to stop that. Even if he personally can get away, it's the issue is whether everybody involved can get away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not an attorney. I can't.
I think it's important to
But I think it's also important to know that under, again, it's still fuzzy, that our laws say that if you know that you can remove yourself from that scene without hurting you or anybody else, you have to do that.
And I guess we keep, or at least I'll just, speaking for myself, I keep personally coming back to the idea of what's wrong with that idea. isn't that what we want people to do? If you can get away from a gunfight without with complete personal safety, isn't that what we want people to do?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. You know, there's a sanctity of life issue that's very compelling with most people and most morals that we all follow, and just guiding rules of life. There's a sanctity of life that's followed there.
And this is why we keep coming back to, you know, looking for examples in Alaska law where the wrong person, what we would all agree is the wrong person, was prosecuted, where Mr. Fayette or one of his colleagues took what we would take to be one of the good guys to court and put a good guy in prison for using self-defense. And you and your staff have both said we don't have that perfect case. It's not out there. The closest we can come is the Wasilla case, and someone died there and someone else was shot in the back. And so I think that's, you know, a case where you sort of have to go to a jury and say, you sort this out.
Mr. Chair, we hesitated to try and bring individual cases like that forward because we're not here to hear the whole case. We're not here to talk about every incident in that case. And if we tried to bring individual cases up, we don't know all the circumstances behind there. So we chose not to try and go out and find individual cases where this could happen. We purposely did that because we don't have all the information to base that on.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Newman, obviously, you know, my respect for you is great, and this issue, and I feel your passion. And as I said earlier to Mr. Fayette, I think Alaskans feel passion on this subject, the right to bear arms, the right to protect your family, all of those things we hold dear. I'd like to hear a little bit about what motivated you to bring this bill up. Is it a case where the NRA, and Brian Judy I respect deeply as well, where there's sort of a legislative program now where we're trying to get, you know, all 50 states to adopt model legislation, check it off the box, or was it a constituent that came to you that had a circumstance like the Wasilla case where there was an unfair prosecution and you're trying to right a wrong? I mean, I understand your hesitance to go in and sort of bring every case to light, but I do think it's important that we understand what problem you're trying to get at, and whether this is the right way to get at it. Because I think, you know, certainly we don't want to go be overly broad and end up creating more problems in our legal system for those who tend to be involved in prosecutions, and that's gang members, in particular in my district. I would just say that, you know, we have growing rates of violence with gang members. I mean, Diamond Center grew up as a kid, I guess you'd say, loitering. I would never allow any of my child or neighbor kids to do that now. It's dangerous. People get shot there. And so my concern is that by offering this broader right of self-defense, are we unwittingly allowing for, more defense opportunities for gang members, people who end up getting prosecuted, and are we going to clog up our courts with that and make it harder on our prosecutors who, you know, are really trying to protect us? And so I just need to hear more. And I want to apologize. We've gotten some emails in our office. This bill was brought up last week. We're running hearings that coincide exactly with this time in finance right now, and I'm a member of finance and a member of this committee. Those hearings are on ACES, so there is a little bit of, you know, why weren't you there? The NRA supported you. Why weren't you in the hearing? And I just want to say, in my self-defense, that I was in finance, and so I apologize if you've already answered this on the record. But could you give me a bit more about why this bill? Why now? What's the motivation?
Absolutely, through the chair, Senator McGuire. And first, may I say, you've been very responsible. You, Senator French, Passman, every member of this committee, Wilkowski, Coghill, have all been very responsive in doing due diligence in what you should be doing, you know, asking good, hard questions before we, you know, move this through. And that's good. You're doing your job, and you've certainly supported movement and hearing of this bill, so nobody should have any negative comments of what you're doing here. And we do have many, many jobs to do in this state. Say that first. What brought this forward? Several things. Again, the case in Big Lake. This was one of my neighbors just down the road. We actually, they're a homeschool family. We passed along some of our supplies and books to their family, quite frankly, because they couldn't afford it. So, you know, I did know the pastor, Milky,
okay,
on this. And because, again, this was brought forth through other states and many of the organizations that we belong to, you know, through discussions on this. And so we brought this forward into the state of Alaska because Alaska is a state with the requirement to leave. And to me, there's a certain sanctity that you have that are allowed under the Castle Doctrine, which allows you to use deadly force to protect yourself while you're in your home. Why should you not have those same rights if you're out in Alaska, if you're out camping, if you're at the Diamond Center? Why should you not have those same fundamental rights? If you've got those rights in your home, why should not those rights follow you as a person? And that's why I brought this forward.
Thank you. You've got a couple more minutes. If you want to close up your presentation, we'll need a few minutes of committee time for other matters, but collect your thoughts if you like, and go ahead and
Mr. Chairman, my include. Staff
yeah.
maybe
yeah.
has
yeah. Mr. Shattuck, yeah, welcome. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Mark Newman. Fundamentally, a lot of the focus in this committee hearing has been on the criminal element itself. And I think a big part of this bill, as was perhaps pointed out by one of the committee members in the last hearing, was we have that part that is the judicial system. Mm-hmm. And those discussions are healthy within them that we take place on what is good, what is justification, what is self-defense, and what isn't. And we know that ultimately when a prosecutor takes on that case, it has to go to the jury for final decision as to whether it's self-defense. That tells us to some degree that piece is working. A prosecutor has the opportunity to prosecute that case. The other piece is that of the individual, a young mother walking across the parking lot at Walmart with her two children.
I like to use cars, but Walmart's fine.
Cars is fine. That's fine.
It's in my neighborhood.
My wife parks the car. Yeah,
there you go.
I missed that one. And so in those particular cases, what we're talking about is the individual having the knowledge that you have, as was pointed out previously, you have objective and subjective decisions that have to be made. You have in that you have an individual who has a gun perhaps pointing in their face, and you yourself had pointed out in the last committee that there was a great quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes, and it basically went to the line of having to have distracted attention when you had a gun in your face or a knife in your face, as he put it. And so the message that's meant to be sent here is justification, imminent danger. If you are in that, or the individual finds themselves in that, as maybe this mother might, then she has a right to protect herself and her children. That's really the key thing here, is the judicial system will have its discussions and healthy cases, but a message that needs to be sent here is to the individual, there's a justification. The justification is imminent danger. If you're in imminent danger, then you have a right to defend yourself in a place where you have a right to be. I would say Representative Newman, the sponsor, was absolutely, you know, correct in pointing out that gangs and gang activities is pointed out in another portion of the statutes, and it's quite clear there what should happen. Perhaps, you know, a problem is the resources that our prosecutors have in terms of being able to fight the good fight. And that might be a totally separate issue, the resources that they have. You know, I think it's also worth pointing out that, you know, as we've gone down the road of hearing this, it's been pointed out on several occasions that, you know, there are members of the House and Senate who are supportive, and they signed on as co-sponsors. The administration itself has also indicated that it's very supportive of this. And so I appreciate, you know, when a prosecutor decides to take his own time and spend his own money and come and give his feel. But there are many elements here that have expressed support for this bill. And so with that, I end my comments.
Thank you both very much. Thank you so much. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside, and we're going to take just a brief at ease while I collect my thoughts about the last 5 minutes of committee.
Thank you, Mark. Sorry.
back on the record. I had planned some time today for a work session on the criminal bills we have in the committee. That is not going to happen because we're out of time, but I want to just orient folks on where I'm going so there's no surprises give you a roadmap, because with 30 days left in the session, we've got several criminal bills here. We need to make decisions on them and move forward so that we give the other body plenty of time to see where we're going. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 six criminal bills in the committee, and let me just start with SB 110. That is Senator Wilikowski's bill on human trafficking. That bill came to us last year. Senator Wilikowski has been working on this for over a year, and the administration was not very supportive of it last year, the governor's now introduced a sex trafficking bill dealing with many of the same elements. My decision has been made to take the elements out of the sex trafficking bill that work with Senator Wilikowski's bill, put them into that, create a CS, and move it along. So that's going to be step one. Step two, Senator McGuire has a task force dealing with human trafficking. She has preferred to have that travel alone. That's what's going to happen with that bill. There's a judiciary bill, SB 186, a Blakely bill, and other provisions we filed on behalf of the administration when they told us that they did not plan to do a criminal bill. Prepared that to move on. We're going to add to that Senator Coghill's amendment regarding raising the felony misdemeanor level cutoff for theft and criminal mischief and so forth. I think it's a good idea. I think it's time to move our statutes more in conformity with the 21st century. It's been some time since that was addressed. Finally, next there's SB 218. That is the other half of the governor's bill. We're going to address that with the video provisions for video conferencing, and there's a part in there that deals with a child pornography a ruling or a pornography ruling that needs to be cleaned up as well. Finally, there is Senator McGuire's SB 210 dealing with felony child assault. That's also going to move forward on its own. She's preferred to not join that with any other provision. So at the next opportunity, you're going to see some CSs doing as I've outlined here today. And that's just to let you and the public know where we're going so we're not slapping big CSs on the table and people can't figure out what's happening. Questions, comments, concerns. Keep working with my office. We've been getting great interaction with your staffs, and I appreciate that. I know everyone's real busy. Senator McGuire's pointed out we're often in two places at once. That's just the end of the session, but we're going to take action. I want to move these bills next week because there is a long way for them to go, and so that's just giving you all a heads up. Thanks so much for being here. With that, we are adjourned.